Well, good morning, Fellowship Greenville. Hello, Auditorium 2. And for all of you on Facebook, thank you so much for joining us this morning. My name is Jonathan Parker, and I'm the Director of City Involvement. If this is your first time, let me add in a special welcome to you. I'm sure you've been met with warm, smiling faces, hot coffee, and what an amazing time of refreshing and engaging worship to our King Jesus. If you have any questions, we have a welcome desk out in the commons, and if you're a regular, we have the Next Steps desk out there as well. We're in our third week of our study of Romans. In the past 2 weeks, Charlie has unearthed the big idea of this letter, which is the gospel that saves us changes us, and the gospel that changes us unites us. The Apostle Paul, the author of Romans, will spend significant time helping the church in Rome understand the why, what, how, and who that the gospel saves between chapters 1 and 4. Because Paul knows that if we don't understand what we've been saved from, we'll never be changed. And if we're never changed, we'll never be united. So understanding this context, let's get to work. If you have your Bibles, join me in Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1. And as you find your place there, let me set some broad context for you. Romans is a letter to the Jewish and Gentile Christians in Rome. Now, when they would have received this letter from Paul, they would have gathered together to hear it read in its entirety. Now, we handle this letter and all of the books of the Bible different in our day. We take sections of them each week until we make our way through studying the whole book. Since this is the case, since this is our practice, we need to take a step back and understand where Paul is headed so that we can understand our text this morning. From Romans 1:18 through 3:19, Paul is taking us on a tour of the human condition, a tour of the human condition. Part of this purpose of this tour is to unify a divided church in Rome by leveling the ground that everyone is equal in their inadequacies before God. Paul sums up this tour towards the end of chapter 3 by saying, "What then? Are the Jews any better off?" No, not at all. "For we've already charged that all, both Jews and Greeks, are under sin. As it is written, none is righteous. No, not one. No one understands. No one seeks God. All have turned aside. Together they've become worthless. No one does good, not even one." If this is the conclusion, can you get a glimpse of what this tour is going to be like? And for the next several weeks, we'll be on this tour of the human condition with Paul as our guide. So let us begin walking with him in Romans chapter 1, verse 18, as we understand the reality. The reality. Starting in verse 18. "For," stop. We didn't get too far. If you write in your Bible or tap on your smartphone or tablet, highlight this word. This simple word "for" or "because" is vital to the understanding of this passage and this entire section in Romans. Paul is drawing our attention back to the thought right before verse 18 where Paul writes, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel. For it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith." My friend Ryan Ferguson from North Hills Church summed up the verses this way. He says, "God's righteousness revealed in the gospel is his powerful declaration that the rebellious and the guilty are now restored and right." Now this gospel, this is good news. But why? "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven." The gospel is good news revealed to all because first, the first part of our reality, the wrath of God is being revealed to all. So now, maybe you're like me and you don't like to talk about wrath, especially the wrath of God. Now, the wrath of God is not an emotional outburst or of anger or frustration, very much like our wrath and anger. But God's wrath is his settled disposition against people who rebel against him. And God's wrath is an uncomfortable topic. So many of you might be thinking, can't we just talk about like grace and peace and love? The wrath of God's really depressing for a Sunday morning. And then there's another group of people that decided to give church a try again today. So you came here, you logged on Facebook, and you decided to sit in a service. We're about to take a tour of the human condition, and we're going to start with a deep conversation about the wrath of God. And you're thinking, I made a mistake. And you're wondering, is this coffee good enough to stay for the rest of the time? The coffee's that good. But regardless, both groups, stay with me. Don't log off just yet. Because even though the wrath of God is an uncomfortable topic, we can't duck, dodge, or dismiss talking about it. For if we do, we dilute grace. Dismissing a conversation about God's wrath is to dilute, to diminish grace. See, wrath is what we deserve. Grace means God doesn't give us what we deserve. Grace makes no sense unless it's contrasted with the dark background of wrath. So, knowing this, Paul starts the tour of the human condition by stating the reality that the wrath of God is being revealed. The original hearers of this letter would have heard the phrase that's in your copy of the scriptures, the wrath of God is revealed in the present tense, meaning that the wrath of God is a present reality that is continually revealed every day against people. And we'll explore a little more of what that means and why that is in a few moments, but let's look at the second part of our reality. And the second part of our reality is that God has made himself known. So the first part is that the wrath of God is being revealed, and the second part is that God has made himself known. So look at verse 19. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that are made. So they are without excuse. Paul tells the believers in Rome that God has revealed the truth about himself all through creation. Paul takes the church in Rome all the way back to the start of history, to the creation of the world, and declares that God put evidence all over creation of his existence. And since the beginning of time, all people have daily intersections with God and the truth that God exists. Creation points to a creator. And avoiding this reality is impossible, because even though God is invisible and eternal, his visible and earthly creation reveals him to everyone. So the result of this reality, that first, the wrath of God is being revealed, and second, that God has made himself known through all creation, the result of this reality is that people are now without excuse. People are now without excuse of our reality. So Paul will now give us seven reasons to explain to the readers in Rome on why people are without excuse, which is our second point this morning, the reasons why the wrath of God is being revealed against all people. The first three reasons can be found in verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. The first three reasons are ungodliness, unrighteousness, and suppressing the truth. Paul uses two words that are generally interchangeable, but in very specific ways. Paul says the wrath of God is against ungodliness. Ungodliness, which is rebellion of and rejection from God. And this is in reference to our vertical brokenness. These would be acts of idolatry, where people put things and other people above God for their safety and security and satisfaction. In ancient times, people would actually take rocks and stone and metal and create images, create idols to be their gods and worship. The idols of today are a little more sophisticated, yet they're no less idols. And the Jewish listeners to this letter would have understood that the word ungodliness here is a summation of the first four commandments, which is in reference to people's relationship with God. Paul then says God's wrath is against unrighteousness, which is the horizontal brokenness. So if ungodliness is the vertical brokenness, which leads to idolatry, unrighteousness is the horizontal brokenness that leads to immorality. Now, immorality is not just restricted to sexual sin. Immorality is all of the wickedness and unkindness and evil we do to one another. And this is summing up commandments 5 through 10, which deal with the relationship we have with one another. So Paul very succinctly has told his readers that God's wrath is revealed against all people because all people have broken the entire law, resulting in a broken relationship with God. And then this ungodliness and unrighteousness leads to one conclusion. And that is the third reason, and that is that by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. Okay, now this only makes sense, right? If we're all guilty of idolatry and immorality, the only way to get that verdict thrown out is to disprove truth. For if there's no truth, then there's no God. And if there's no God, we can live however we want, worship whatever we want, and treat one another however we want. Yet it's impossible to ignore the truth of God because God has made it clear in unavoidable and unmistakable ways throughout all of creation. So Paul continues to lay out reasons, but he starts with saying it's ungodliness. It's unrighteousness. It's suppressing the truth about God. But he continues to let us know why this indictment against us is true in verses 21 and 22. Paul says this, "For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened, claiming to be wise. They became fools." The next three reasons are that people did not honor, were not grateful, and became fools. A quick side note here. This verse is a clear example of the timeless truth of the Bible. The fallen human condition and the behavior that accompanies it has been consistent throughout all of history. People have been behaving this way since all the way back from the fall. And even though our culture may have more avenues and ways for us to express this type of behavior, it has been consistent throughout all of history. And while we're on this tour of the human condition over the next several weeks, we'll begin to see that the culture in Rome wasn't much different than the world we live in today. But let's get back to this passage. Paul is explaining to the church in Rome that even though God has clearly revealed himself in all of creation, and that all people have some knowledge, some knowing that an all-powerful, a divinity, an eternal God created everything, even though they know that, they choose dishonor and ingratitude. N.T. Wright, a theologian, says the appropriate response to divine self-revelation in creation would be worship and thanksgiving. Yet all people run from this response. An attempt to disprove a creator, because if creation's not true, then this creator, that's a legend, and wrath now must just be a myth. The attempt to disprove what is theologically called natural revelation, or simply God revealing himself in creation, leads people to become futile, resultless, useless in their thinking, and foolish in their living. So what is the consequence of this spiral, the spiral of ungodliness to unrighteousness, to suppressing the truth, to dishonor, to ingratitude, to being foolish? What is the result of this spiral path? Well, that's Paul's seventh reason. And it's that we've exchanged glory for glimpses. Paul concludes his reasons for all people being equal recipients of God's wrath by saying that all people, in verse 23, exchange the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. The only destination a person can arrive after following this path is exchanging the greater for the lesser. The only conclusion of following this path is to exchange the greater for the lesser. The giver for the gifts, the creator for the creation, the immortal for the mortal, the infinite for the finite, the image for the reflection, the glory for the glimpses, the greater for the lesser. The wrath of God is being revealed against all people. Because in spite of God clearly revealing and showing himself to all people look for whatever they can to exchange for him. Paul is letting this divided church in Rome know that the reality of the world since the fall of creation is that all people practice idolatry and immorality while suppressing the truth about God. That even though God has kindly and divinely revealed himself throughout all of creation, our response, our chosen response is dishonor and ingratitude, which leads to us living foolish lives with futile thinking. And then the conclusion is we exchange the greater for the lesser. So then, what does this mean for us? How does this portion of Romans that Paul wrote, the beginning of the tour of our reality, that the wrath of God is revealed, is being revealed against all people, and that he's made himself known, and then the reasons that all people practice ungodliness and unrighteousness and suppressing the truth, and they're dishonorable and ungrateful, and they become fools in their thinking and living, and then the conclusion, they exchange the greater for the lesser. What does this mean for us today? What is our response? What is our response? Maybe you're sitting here this morning relieved. For the majority of this message, you've been thinking, I am glad I am not those people. I am just glad I'm not those people. From the moment you heard these verses read, you immediately had categories of people in mind and groups of people that didn't include you. And this was the same situation that the believers in Rome were facing. They were facing our human condition. See, the believers in Rome were fundamentally divided because one group thought they weren't those people, or they were better than those people. And this type of thinking has its root in the belief that their human condition was somehow less vile, less sick, less fallen, less broken, less immoral and idolatrous than someone else's. And Jesus warns us about such thinking. In the book of Luke, we're told that Jesus told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. He says, two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed, God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, and even like this tax collector. But the tax collector, standing afar off, would not even lift his eyes to heaven, but beat on his chest, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Jesus says, I tell you, this man, this tax collector, went down to his house justified rather than the other. We have a tendency today to hear this passage in Romans explained and think like the Pharisee. I'm glad I'm not like other men. If you believe this passage in Romans does not include you, if you have one little hint that you're better, you've missed this entire point. See, Paul's process of unifying this church starts with a tour of the human condition that begins by reminding all people everywhere that apart from the righteousness of Jesus applied to your souls, we are all equal in deserving God's wrath. Paul will tell us in a few verses, you have no excuse, oh man, every one of you who judges. For in passing judgment on another, you condemn yourself because you, the judge, practice the same things. But it's easy to pass judgment, isn't it? When we see or hear of someone or a group of people that fit this description of people under wrath, it's easy to say, thank God I'm not like them. But when you think us and them, when you have categories of us and them, you've misunderstood this passage and you're missing the point of grace. Grace, which is God's lavish, immeasurable, and undeserving favor towards us. Grace found in the gospel is the remedy for our broken, sickly, and desperate condition. If you have the slightest inkling that your brokenness is in any less desperate need of God's grace and the gospel's power to save than someone else's, you have tragically overestimated your state and yourself. Jesus said, for those who are well, they have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. Jesus says, I came not to call the righteous, but sinners. So for us to understand and celebrate the gospel, Fellowship Greenville, for us to be this community of grace that passionately pursues life and mission with Jesus, we must never forget our dire need for that grace. For if we forget, we are as self-righteous as that Pharisee in Jesus' story. I would like us to dwell on this concept and engage our mind and our emotions and what we are without Jesus. From Auditorium 2, Johnny and Matt are gonna play a song from 1850. Hundreds of years ago, Christians, especially hymn writers, never got over their deep need for grace in light of their dire need of sin. And I believe that this aspect of remembrance is a practice that we might need to revisit more often so that we never forget our desperate need for grace. Think on these words. Allow the weight of your need to rest on you. And pray like the tax collector, God, be merciful to me, a sinner.
Lord, I deserve your deepest wrath. Ungrateful and faithless I have been. terrors my soul have deterred. No goodness wooed me from my sin. My heart is vile, my mind depraved. My flesh rebels against your will. I am polluted in your sight. Is there a mercy for me still? I'm the sickness, I'm the cause of my grief. I am drowning in shame. And a thief, I'm the source of my pain. Without defense, I look to you. Without a friend, in deep distress to you I cry. I'm the sickness, I'm the cause of my grief. I'm drowning in shame. I'm the problem, a hypocrite and a thief. I'm the source of my pain. I'm the sickness, I'm the cause of my grief. I am drowning in shame. I'm the problem, a hypocrite and a thief. I'm the source of my pain. Lord, I deserve your deepest wrath.
What is the hope to a helpless condition? Michael Ware, in his book, Reclaiming Hope, says, hope has been both misused and underappreciated in our time. We have bought into false hope and been disappointed so many times that we've learned to doubt hope itself. Paul tells us here in this section of Romans that there is no hope for a world that turns its back on God. We can't dig ourselves out of this pit. There's not enough self-help, self-esteem, or self-motivational books, programs, or speeches that we can embrace that can undo this human condition. And although all of us, myself included, at some point have tried to buy false hope of good works, religious practices, and even a deep belief in self, all to be left with staring our own deficiencies and despair in the face and feeling even more hopeless. See, we fall short by miles, not inches, from the righteousness of God. We fall short by miles. So are we without hope? There's two groups of people sitting in this building today or sitting at home watching on Facebook. There's two groups of people. First, that's me. That's me. I am completely under the wrath of God. And then the second group is, I have forgotten that was me. And I have good news for you both. I have good news for you both, and it's both found in the same place. It's found in our faith condition. As I mentioned in the beginning, the original hearers would have heard this letter read in its entirety in one sitting, and we didn't have time to do that today, so we must pull back once again to understand this passage and our response. See, Paul is contrasting the wrath of God in verse 18 through 23 with the righteousness of God in verse 16 and 17. He's contrasting the wrath of God in which we read and the righteousness of God, which Charlie talked about last week. And here it is. Our hope is found in the contrast. Your hope, my hope, is found in the contrast. So if you're in that first group, if you're in the first group, who say, I know I'm under the wrath of God. The hope for you is found in the gospel, and the gospel is the good news about Jesus. See, Jesus on the cross took all, absorbed all, felt all, carried all the wrath of God for you. All of the wrath of God we talked about today was placed and applied on Jesus, and he died as your substitute. Jesus died under the weight of sin that deserved all of God's wrath. But 3 days later, he rose again in bold declaration that the wrath of God is now satisfied to all who believe. So today, right in this moment, whatever auditorium you're in or wherever you're sitting across our world, today, if you are under wrath, you can believe in the power of God to save you from the wrath of God. You can move from your faith condition of hopelessness to a faith condition of eternal hope. That is good news for you. Maybe you find yourself in the second group. I forgot that was me. There's hope for you too, found in the gospel. See, as Charlie talked about last week, our faith is an everyday faith life, an everyday faith life. And since this is the case, we need to begin to ask ourselves every day, do how I live reflect that I've been moved from wrath to righteousness? Does my life reflect one who have believed the gospel? It might be helpful for us to start asking ourselves questions like, do I make idols of other people and things above God for my safety, security, and significance? Do I make idols? Do I treat people unjustly? Do I judge people, use gossip or ungracious speech about people, whether to their face, behind their back, or on social media? Do I have a sense of superiority over people or groups of people? Do I suppress the truth of God because it goes contrary to how I want to live and I want to go about life? Do I have a spirit of entitlement rather than gratefulness? Do I exchange the greater for the lesser? See, even though in Christ, clothed in God's righteousness, we who have believed the gospel are no longer condemned. Yet sometimes our life still looks like, sometimes our behaviors still look like those who are under wrath. So today we looked at the behavior, the life pattern of people who are under wrath. So what does it look like to have a life pattern of people who are under righteousness? Well, again, our hope is in the contrast. those who have experienced the power of God live lives that reflect the righteousness that we read about in 16 and 17, which is the opposite, the direct opposite of 18 through 23. See, people who believe the gospel, who have been moved from wrath to righteousness, they worship God as supreme. They worship God as supreme, and they don't put anything above him to give significance or security or safety. They treat other people. They treat other people with humility and kindness and grace. Yes, they speak the truth about God, but they always do it in love. And they observe creation. They look around them to the daily intersects of the fingerprints of God, and they admire and celebrate his handiwork and give him honor. See, they have attitudes of gratefulness, thanksgiving, and joy because they know what they've been saved from. And they exchange the lesser for the greater, because they understand that nothing compares to the exchange that took place that moved them from under wrath to clothed in righteousness. So the faith life, the faith condition, the everyday faith of those who believe the gospel is one of remembrance of the wrath deserved, but the grace received. The gospel that saves us changes us. And the gospel that changes us unites us. This tour of the human condition is vital for our understanding because it reveals the pit of hopelessness we were in. It reveals the broken condition. It reveals the separation from God. It reveals the deserved punishment to our ungodliness and our unrighteousness. We can't miss this tour. Despite how uncomfortable it is, we must go through it together. Because by going through it, may we never be that Pharisee. May we never forget our dire position we were before Christ, so that we may always treasure and value and proclaim the grace that moved us from wrath to righteousness. And what is the only appropriate response? The only appropriate response is in contrast, again, rather than run from God. We celebrate and worship God, our great God who saves. Father, I thank you that you did not leave us without a remedy, that you did not leave us in our hopeless condition, but that you sent your Son, poured your wrath on him, and then 3 days later, he arose from the grave, defeating death and defeating wrath, so that those who call on his name, those who believe this good news, will never have to experience wrath. And for the believer today, Father, your son and daughter, remind them of your grace poured out freely in contrast to where we are without you. That is good news.